I waited for the friar to catch up. He spoke loudly so that the whole crowd could hear. I imagined that D'Souza's gift of languages would only carry him so far, but as long as the heathens understood the fundamentals of what I was trying to convey, I would be satisfied. "But do not think that you can harm us, for we are gods to you." The priest stuttered a bit as he translated that bit of blasphemy. "You have witnessed the power we control. I can call fire from the heavens and smite you to dust. You cannot harm us, but you can try. If you try, you will be punished. Is that understood?" The priest finished and the king bowed before me. The royal party did so as well. Jaguar helmets touched the ground as their army followed suit. I could grow used to this. All bowed, except one, a dark-skinned woman in the opulent robes of a priestess. She alone met my gaze. She stood proudly as the other members of her strange priesthood cowered. I had not seen such beauty and poise since I had been banished from the royal court so long ago. I gestured for two of my men to seize her and bring her forward. She held up a hand to stop them, and approached of her own volition. The king glared at her as she made her way across the courtyard, and hissed something at her in their incomprehensible language. I spurred my horse forward. With a snort and flared nostrils, the mighty beast knocked the king roughly to the ground. The royal party gasped in astonishment as the old broken man scurried away from my war horse's iron-shod hooves. "Who are you, and why do you think you should not bow?" She was a beautiful wench, and it was going to be a waste to kill her as an example, but the pagan should not be allowed to see weakness from my army. My fingers drifted toward the handle of my axe. Regardless of the answer, I planned to take her head, though perhaps if she amused me I would have my way with her first, and I would do it in front of the royal family. Friar D'Souza hurriedly translated. She cut him off.
"I am Corineha, High Priestess of the Temple of Nehor."
My hand moved away from my axe. "How do you speak our tongue?" Many of my priests and soldiers began to murmur at this surprise. We were the first civilized Christians to make it this far into the interior of the continent, that we knew of at least. Had some of the blasted Spaniards beaten us here?
"There is power here, untapped for generations. I have learned your language in preparation for this very day. The spirits burned your words into me so that I may speak with you," she boldly retorted. "I have been waiting for you. Your coming was prophesied by the old ones. Your men come here searching for riches like pigs, simple in their greed. Your priests come for souls, numbers to feed their machine. But you, my Lord Machado, you are different. Your quest is for power. It is what you seek in your heart. I can offer you power. Power beyond your dreams."
"She is a witch!" exclaimed Friar D'Souza. "Kill her, Lord Machado! The devil has given her our speech!" "Silence, priest! Do not presume to tell me what to do." The friar bowed his head in submission. I was interested. Something about the beautiful priestess provoked something deep in the back of my mind. "What do you speak of, woman? Make it good, or I will be most displeased by this interruption." She bowed slightly.
"I can offer you much, Lord Machado. With my help, I can keep this city docile and willing to serve you."
"They will do that now," I stated.
"But only out of fear. You are a wise general. You know that eventually they will rebel. Brave ones will rise up, as they always do. I know that you are only men, mighty and wise men, to be sure, but you must sleep, and you must eat our food, and your flesh can be pierced by an assassin's blade when your guards are not alert. You need not rule this city out of fear, if I can make this people serve and worship you. Why plunder one country, one people, when you can instead bend that city to your will and use it to build your own kingdom out of this land? I found myself intrigued by the ruthless cunning of the witch. Tell me more, priestess.
I blinked, and the vision was gone. I was no longer an unwitting passenger in the cursed one's memory. We were back in the destroyed church, except now the make-believe world was no longer in sharp focus. There were blank spots around us, filled with nothing. The old man was losing his concentration. He was sitting on the steps of the altar, pale and wheezing. His hands were shaking. I sat down next to him.
Sorry, boy. Can only do for so long. It's very difficult.
What were you trying to show me? I felt unclean from seeing the world through the cursed one's eyes, feeling his pride and his calculating mind, hearing his thoughts, and experiencing his casual brutality.
Can't explain. Must show. I will try again if there is time. But now am weak. Very weak.
How are you tied to Lord Machado? The old man was silent. He gently tapped the hardwood floor of the church with his cane, apparently lost in thought. How are you tied to him? I want to help you.
Don't worry about me, boy. I am trapped. I am no matter.
Do you know where he is, or where he is going? Can you show me a current memory?
He laughed tiredly.
You can see his old memories from when he was man, but now, one look in his head, and you either dead or go crazy.
He used his finger to make a swirling motion around his ear, the universal sign of insanity.
Maybe I can send image, maybe like photograph from what he sees. I will try, after I rest.
Thank you. I thought for a moment. One last thing.
Hurry.
What about the tattooed man?
Guardian of the artifact. Do not trust. He wants one thing. Just one thing. Get in his way.
The old man dragged his bony finger across his throat and made a gack sound.
You go now. Help your lady friend. Keep her safe. She is good girl. You two make cute babies someday.
He patted me on my arm.
Huh? Go, stupid boy. Try not to get dead.
I awoke with a start. My alarm was buzzing with all of the gentleness of an air raid siren. I pounded the snooze button and jumped out of bed, alert and breathless. The sun would not rise for a few more hours, but I had to tell the others about my dream immediately. I still did not understand exactly what was happening to me, but somehow I was being given some serious knowledge about our adversary. I threw on a t-shirt and a pair of jeans and rushed out of the barracks, not even bothering with shoes. I crashed into Trip on the way out the door. He swore as he spilled his coffee. I shouted an apology as I sprinted for the main office building. The MHI library was located in the basement. It was a massive room, tight with shelves and dusty tables. All of the company's monster encounters had been logged and documented for the last 100 years. In addition, books of topical value had been brought here by more scholarly-minded hunters the entire time. In total, There was a century of accumulated paper moldering away in that room. It was probably the world's biggest collection of actual monster lore, but it was a daunting task to find any one particular thing. I found Earl Harbinger in the archives, staring vacantly at a heavy old book. From his appearance, I could not tell if he had gotten up really early or if he had never gone to sleep.
"Another dream? Did you learn something?"
I nodded in the affirmative.
"What did you get?"
It was weird, but I got his whole name. General João Silva de Machado, and I know a lot more about him. He was an evil bastard when he was human, and apparently he's just gotten worse with age. Harbinger smiled tiredly. Apparently that was the best news he had gotten lately.
"Good work. With that, I bet we can pin him down. I'll go get the others," he said as he left.
I pulled out a chair and sat down tiredly. Whatever happened when I had these dreams, it certainly wasn't restful. I put my head down on the old wood table. I closed my eyes. The minutes ticked by. I did not feel so good. Then the vision began. The old man had been true to his word. Once he had recovered enough, he attempted to bring me a more recent memory from the cursed one. This was merely a visual snapshot, just a single image that might help us locate the enemy, nothing more. However, it came from such a tortured mind, so filled with hate and darkness and pain, that just the brief second I felt the connection was enough to knock me to the ground and leave me gasping for air in a blind panic. The old man must have made a mistake. I could feel the cursed one as he sensed me intruding. I could feel his anger and his promise to destroy me and the very fabric of my world. He sent me a message. I screamed in agony and clutched my face as I was racked with spasms of unspeakable pain. Crashing out of the chair, I twitched wildly as thousands of invisible blades stabbed at my flesh. Tears streamed from my eyes as I thrashed about, trying to evade the pain. Everything went mercifully black. The others were standing over me. Julie was kneeling at my side, her hand gently resting on my forehead. They all looked very concerned.
"What happened?"
"You were having a seizure or something," she said. "How do you feel?"
"Like crap. That wasn't a seizure. Lord Machado sensed me. I had another vision."
"While you were awake?"
Harbinger asked sharply. "I requested it. Last night in my dream. I asked for a picture. A current memory." The other hunters looked at each other in confusion.
"I'll explain later. Look,"
I tried to sit up, but I was too dizzy. I gave up and embraced the cold floor.
"I saw one of his memories. I saw the world through the cursed one's eyes. I don't know from when, but it was a recent memory."
"Oh, and take it easy. Tell us what you saw."
Julie's voice was soothing and relaxed.
"He was in some sort of vehicle. It was dark. I just saw the road illuminated in the headlights. They were approaching a sign."
"What did it say?"
Julie asked. "Welcome to Alabama."
Chapter 14. The Appleton Asylum was located on the banks of the Alabama River. It was an isolated location, far off the main road, nestled deep into the thick surrounding trees. According to the map, it was only 60 miles from the MHI compound, but the barely paved route to the asylum was so circuitous that I think we had to go twice that far. The nearest actual town was Camden, and to call it close was a stretch. The afternoon air was still thick with dew. Spanish moss dangled over the roads, dappling them in shadow, and dragged along the roof of our van. The asylum itself was an enormous, four-story Gothic construction, gray and stern, surrounded by a high, wrought-iron security fence. The narrow windows were barred, and the building emanated a quiet bleakness. The sign above the entrance said, Appleton. I had almost been expecting it to have a quote from Dante's Inferno instead. Julie and I had slipped away after the morning debriefing. I had given as much detail for my dream as I could to the other hunters. None of us really knew what it all meant, but we knew that the Cursed One and his minions were now on our turf. Unfortunately, as near as we could figure, there were at least a dozen roads along the border that had a sign like the one I had seen. Plus, we had no idea how old the memory was. Reports had begun to drift in that the government had activated all of the National Guard units in the southeastern U.S., including units that had just gotten back from long deployments overseas. The morning news had a report showing tanks and trucks parked at the far mounds in Mississippi. Reports indicated that there were also troops protecting Civil War battlefields, Indian burial grounds, and historic monuments. The spokesman from the Department of Homeland Security explained that it was merely an exercise to prepare for potential terrorist threats. Apparently, the feds were nervous as well, and trying to cover any spots that might potentially be the place of power. Julie Shackelford was silent as she drove up to the gate. She had barely spoken during the drive. Her lips were set in a hard line, and she wore a look of concentration similar to the one that she had before we had stormed the bowels of the Antoine Henri. She tapped her fingers nervously on the steering wheel. She was not looking forward to speaking with her father. "It will be okay, Julie. Don't worry about it," I said, in an inane attempt at comforting her.
"Are your parents weird?"
she responded, still staring out the window. She had stopped beside the security intercom, but she had not yet hit the button. "Mom thinks that if we don't eat all of her cooking, we don't love her. When she gets excited, she forgets to speak English. My dad made us kids call him Sergeant."
"Well, Owen, that sounds like Leave It to Beaver to me. My mom disappeared on a mission, and my dad locked himself in a library for a few years. He twisted the forces of ancient and unspeakable evil to his will and tore open a rift in the fabric of space and time to bring her soul back from the other side. He failed, and a horde of rampaging demons from a different dimension killed most of the friends I have ever had. Now Mom is still dead, and Dad's insane. So don't think that you can tell me that it is okay."
"Got it," I answered. So much for being helpful. Another minute passed in silence. Finally, with a dejected sigh, she rolled down the van window and pushed the intercom button.
"Who is it?"
asked the tinny and static-laced voice of the intercom.
"Julie Shackelford. I'm here to visit my father, Raymond Shackelford. He is a patient of the doctor's Nelson."
There was a long pause before the heavy iron gate creaked open under hydraulic pressure. We drove through. "Doctors Nelson?"
"Lucius and Joan. Husband and wife team. One is a psychiatrist, the other is a psychologist. I can't remember which is which, though."
"What's the difference?"
"Beats me. I was a history major. You're the trivia nut," she replied. "They are actually both retired hunters. They bought this place from the state when they left MHI. They're good folks. I've known them since I was a kid. They are getting up in age, but they do really good work here. The Nelsons have done some great research. They help a lot of people with special problems."
"Special problems?"
"Mostly they work with regular mental problems, like any treatment center. but they specialize in people who have had monster encounters. Not everybody has a flexible mind like those of us who become hunters, she answered.
I had never thought about that. I was still internally freaking out about the things that were happening to me. I can only imagine how some people would react from that kind of trauma. Apparently, here was my answer. We parked in the near-empty lot under a large tree. Thick leaves dangled across the windshield. Julie cautioned me to make sure the door was locked. Her suggestion made sense, considering that there were crazy people roaming the lawn, and we had something like a dozen firearms, grenade launchers, a flamethrower, edged weapons, and several pounds of high explosive in the back of our huge Ford passenger van. The grounds around the asylum were immaculate. The lawns were green, and comfortable chairs had been placed in various strategic locations for the patients to make themselves at ease. A group of casually dressed people were sitting in a circle, listening to one of their own tell a story. The woman was very animated, and obviously distressed.
They would bite me, and it would hurt, and they would suck on me until I was so weak I was almost dead. But they would never kill me. They would just go until they got full, and then they would just stick me in the hole with the others. They would throw enough food down the hole to keep us alive. It was always dark, so we couldn't tell what we were eating, but it was always raw meat. But we were so weak and hungry that we had no choice.
The woman was crying and shaking. She was twisting the bottom of her Winnie the Pooh sweatshirt violently. She was young, and had probably been very pretty once, but was now prematurely aged from stress.
Sometimes, when one of us would finally get too weak and finally die, then the next day there would be more food. So we knew what it was. But we were too weak to fight. Some of us went crazy. Crazy. Waiting for them to come back and drag another one of us out of the hole to feed on. It went on and on like that. I don't know how long, because it was always dark. So dark.
She finally broke down in deep, pitiful sobs. An older woman, who was obviously a doctor, stood and comforted her, hugging her and telling her that she was so brave, that it was all going to be okay now. The group echoed the sentiment, congratulating the woman for sharing. The crying patient returned to her seat. "Vampires," said a man who had stopped beside me. I had been so distracted by the patient's story that I had not heard him approach. He was a short, pudgy gentleman with huge, thick glasses and wild hair. His pants were hitched up over his belly button and kept there with a giant pair of suspenders. If I were to guess, I would have to say that he was in his 60s.
"One of the ways that they stay off the radar, abduct some poor folks and keep them locked in a pen like cattle. Rotate through, feeding just enough to keep them alive. They don't need to take as many victims that way. Keeps them from drawing the attention of hunters. Saddest part of all is that even if a victim has only been bitten once, even if it was years and years before, when they die, they will return as a vampire themselves. That's the real reason we embalm people nowadays. Keeps them from coming back. Even though this poor girl survived, she has to deal with that knowledge the rest of her life."
"Dr. Nelson,"
Julie exclaimed. She hugged the man. He grunted as she almost lifted him off of his feet.
"Ah, little Julie, you have grown so much. My gosh, let me have a look at you."
He studied her for a moment at arm's length.
"My dear, you look just like your mother. Susan was a beautiful woman, too."
I swear that Julie, the fearless monster hunter, blushed.
"Thanks, Doc. I'm told that a lot. Everybody loved Mom."
"Yes, we did. She was a shining light to all of us knuckle-dragging hooligans. She kept us in line. Kept me and Joan alive on more than one occasion as well. How is your grandfather?" Still a cantankerous old bastard, I hope. Is he well?
Of course, on the cantankerous part. Health-wise, he's getting older, but he's tough.
Good, good. And Earl, staying out of trouble? He needs to call more often to check in. I would love to write a paper about his condition if he would just sit on my couch long enough for an interview.
Earl is good. I'll tell him to call.
She changed the subject.
This is Owen Pitt, one of our newest hunters.
The doctor shook my hand. His grip was strong for an old man. His grin was infectious.
Nice to meet you.
He pumped my arm vigorously.
Considerable facial scarring. Claws, yes?
Werewolf, I said, self-consciously touching my face. I pushed him out of a tall building.
You must be the lad from Dallas, then. Good show on that one. I knew as soon as I saw the report that you would become a hunter, though I would not have minded having you here for my research. Werewolf encounter, survivor's guilt, and a near-death experience, all in one patient? My, but that would make a splendid paper. Perhaps, if you have the time, you could give me a blow-by-blow account. Maybe tell me about any psychosomatic problems you have faced since. Obviously not lack of appetite.
He punched me lightly in the stomach.
Perhaps bad dreams or sexual dysfunction, then?
Julie snickered at my discomfort. Luckily, I was spared any further quizzing by the arrival of the other Dr. Nelson. She was a small, thin, bird-like woman. She was probably about the same age as her husband, but the main thing that they had in common was the enormously thick glasses. She also hugged Julie, but before they could even converse, Dr. Joan called the group of patients over.
Look, everybody, these two people are from Monster Hunter International. They are real, live monster hunters.
I waved sheepishly. Some of the patients oohed and aahed. Others held back and sullenly smoked cigarettes.
You are so brave. Hunter saved my life. You were my savior. Thank you.
Probing hands grabbed at me. I was hugged and kissed on the cheeks, and tears fell onto my clothing. I was stunned by the outpouring of emotion, and mostly tried to keep my hands on my concealed weapons. I did not want to find out if any of the patients were feeling suicidal or homicidal. Finally, the crowd drew back, leaving Julie and me disheveled and tear-stained. It was a strange experience to be thanked by total strangers for things which I had never done.
Where were you people when my kids were getting torn apart?
One of the patients snarled. He was a middle-aged man who did not look comfortable in casual clothing.
Now, now, Barney. The hunters are only human. They can't be everywhere. They can only do their best. We can all learn from that example.
The female Dr. Nelson clapped her hands.
Okay, everyone. The sharing circle is done for today. It's lunchtime. Today we are having meatloaf.
Bah!
The man named Barney spit on the ground in my general direction and stormed away. The group dispersed.
What's his problem?
I asked.
He must not like meatloaf,
Lucius Nelson answered. The interior of the asylum was much warmer and friendlier than the Gothic exterior. The Nelsons had remodeled the building until it looked less like a state-run ward and more like a comfortable and relaxing place to live. The walls were painted warm colors, and the staff was courteous and friendly. Julie had gone with Dr. Joan to see her father. She had understandably not wanted my company for the painful meeting. If we were needed, Dr. Lucius had his beeper. I was getting the tour.
Those patients you met are some of the more well-adjusted people we have staying here. Most of them are on the verge of really dealing with their issues. Hopefully, some of them will be able to return to the world soon. We also, I'm afraid, have others who are not doing so well. This common area is made up of people who are no longer really a danger to themselves or others. The other sections have greater security. Which one is Ray Shackelford in? Maximum security. He is actually a ward of the state, and only released into our custody because of the nature of our facility. We are required to keep him locked up and guarded. Is Julie going to be safe? I could not help but ask. I saw that girl beat an Indonesian blood fiend into submission when she was 16 years old. I'm not worried. But just in case, Ray has been restrained. I would have administered drugs, but I'm guessing that you want him lucid. He adjusted his suspenders. I wish that MHI would have called and warned us you were coming. It was kind of a surprise decision. I shrugged. Some of the patients were playing ping-pong. One of them had scars that made my own look minuscule. Well, I'm glad that Julie is finally speaking with her father. I just hope that she has prepared herself for this. It could be potentially traumatic. He chuckled softly. That is why my wife went with her instead of me. She is the loving one. He pointed at other patients as we continued walking. Part of the problem we face here is the whole government-mandated secrecy about monsters. Many of our patients were put into regular mental health facilities after their encounters, before we were able to find out about them and bring them here. Unfortunately, when a severely traumatized individual is taken in for treatment, and they are already struggling with the reality of what they have experienced, regular doctors are not much help. Can you imagine going to a normal psychologist and explaining that your boss turned into a werewolf and tried to eat you? He did not wait for me to answer. They would think that you were delusional, and they would pump you full of drugs. You know what you saw. They don't think that is possible. So, after a while, the sane and healthy patient begins to doubt their own memories. That leads to insecurity, and that snowballs into all sorts of mental problems. If you can't trust your own memory, who can you trust? I got security camera video, I replied. Ha! Like most of these poor people get to see anything like that. Damn quacks can ignore piles of evidence because they are sure that monsters are only figments of our subconscious. I've read huge textbooks explaining how the werewolf and vampire legends that date back to the dawn of recorded civilization and span every single culture on the planet are neatly explained by mass hysteria, religious fervor, vain attempts at understanding natural pathological psychoses, or even hallucinations caused by ergot in bad rye bread. Ha! Joan and I were stalking vampires while we were still in med school, so our methods are a little unorthodox in the scientific community. Learn this, Mr. Pitt. There are three kinds of people in the world. People who can't believe in anything, suckers who believe in everything, and a few of us who can face the truth.
We stopped in front of a large security door. A hulking orderly nodded at us, and Dr. Nelson scanned his badge to get us through. We entered a long corridor, lined with steel doors with small window slits. Screaming, crying, and gibbering nonsense echoed through the hall. It gave me shivers.
This ward is for people who have had serious monster trauma and are not coping with it well. They are suicidal, violent, or unable to distinguish reality from fantasy.
We stopped before a door. I peered through the slit. A man was sitting cross-legged in the corner. He was wearing a straitjacket, and he was softly beating his head against the padded wall. He was humming, "Mary Had a Little Lamb," over and over again. Drool was running down his chin and forming a puddle on the floor.
Believe it or not, Carlos here was a monster hunter. He worked for MHI up until about 15 years ago. He was one of our team leads in New England. Brilliant man. Great hunter. Good leader.
What happened? I asked softly.
Carlos cocked his head to the side as if listening to something very far away. After a few seconds, he went back to humming.
Have you ever read any H.P. Lovecraft, Mr. Pitt?
Please, just call me Owen.
I read a little bit when I was a kid.
Why?
I did not say that his stories had given me nightmares.
Lovecraft was no hunter, but he heard the stories, and he did his research. He had a pretty good idea of what was out there. If you remember, a common theme in his work was the protagonist's gradual descent into madness over a period of being exposed to the darkness of the other side. There are things out there which man is not meant to ever see or understand. Poor Carlos here is a perfect example.
What did he see?
Nobody knows. His whole team went missing, and he was found wandering in the countryside, naked and confused. Just keep that in mind as you continue your career, Owen. There are some things that are best just left alone.
We exited the ward, leaving Carlos and the others to their songs. Lunch was filling, and the meatloaf was surprisingly edible, considering it was mass-produced in an insane asylum's cafeteria. Dr. Joan called at one point to tell us that Ray was finally speaking a little bit to his daughter. I overheard part of the conversation. He was coherent, but the Shackelford family reunion was not exactly a joyous occasion. After we ate, the tour continued, terminating on the back lawns of the Appleton Asylum, overlooking the sluggish Alabama River. A high fence ensured that none of the patients decided to take a swim. It had rained briefly, and this time it was enough to break the humidity and lower the temperature to an almost comfortable degree. As we walked along the lawns, many other patients came up to speak with me. Some wanted to touch my hands or give me hugs. Many of them thanked me for what I did with heartfelt emotion. I was not used to such attentions.
They are trying to give their thanks. Of course, I find out about many of my patients from your organization. Many of them would not be alive if it weren't for MHI or your competitors, the good doctor explained. They see people like you as saviors, as heroes, as champions.
I'm no hero, I replied. I'm not even particularly brave.
It doesn't matter. Everybody needs something to believe in. So, for those of us who have been hurt by evil, they need to have champions of good to offset that in their minds. For the victims, they see people like you as Batman or the Lone Ranger. It keeps their worlds in balance. Mankind needs our heroes.
I'm not sure exactly what I am, but I'm nobody's champion.
Don't be so sure. I've been around hunters longer than you have been alive. It is a job that requires bravery to the point of insanity. Everyone has their own reasons. Some of us are just in this for the money. Others are in it for the thrill. Others because they need a place to vent their violence in a manner that is not only legal, but encouraged. Some do it out of a thirst for revenge. Some, like Julie, I'm afraid, do it because it is the only world they know or really fit into. And then there are the few, the very, very few, who do it because they really are heroes, and they don't have it in them to be anything else.
I thought of Tripp when he said that. My friend was in this for the right reasons. He just wanted to do good and help people. Guys like him were the heroes. I was just an accountant with a gun.
So why are you doing this, Owen?
You going to psychoanalyze me now, Doc?
He laughed.
I'm just a curious man by nature.
Honestly, I don't know. I'm still not sure this is right for me. Why? I scratched my head. Well, he was a shrink after all. Growing up, my father had this weird apocalyptic idea about the future, and he wanted me to be ready for it. So he pushed me into something that I didn't really think I wanted to be. Then, when I got older, I felt like I let him down. So I did something really stupid, lost my temper, and almost killed somebody who probably deserved it, but that's besides the point. So when I tried to distance myself from that kind of thing and tried to be normal, I find myself involved in something even worse than before. Monsters are real, and it looks like maybe my father was right all along. And the future really is bleak, and I'm supposed to be a violent brute, and it's good that I'm good at killing things. But I still lost my temper and almost killed another hunter, who once again probably deserved it, but at least the sharks didn't eat him. So I'm still managing to screw stuff up. Now I'm having visions and hearing voices. Okay. I'm going to need to bump a few appointments for my calendar this afternoon to squeeze you in. No time for that, since it looks like some super monster is trying to destroy time, and somehow I'm tagged by fate or the universe or something to fight him. But when this is over, if I live, I really need to figure out, do I really want to do this kind of thing? Or is it better to just forget this ever happened and go back to my normal life? Dr. Nelson digested my ramblings for a few moments while we strolled along the walk. He shrugged. Normal people are lame. Stick with monster hunting. We stopped as another patient came up to shake my hand. Thank you for what you do, he stated vacantly. The screaming killer frogs done ate my whole family, but y'all came and saved the rest of the town. Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome, I said. I did not have the heart to tell him that I did not even know what a screaming killer frog was. Our pleasure. You just get some rest and get to feeling better, okay? He thanked me a few more times before letting go of my hand. He had some information to share. There are some killer frogs flying around. Big ones. These ones are shaped like men, but bigger. And they have wings and horns, so I reckon they ain't really frogs. But you know how that goes. I done saw them in the trees by the river watching the place. If you get a chance, Mr. Hunter, sir, you should probably go kill them or something.
Thank you for the information, Travis. We will look into it.
The doctor patted the young man on the shoulder and sent him on his way. We watched as he ambled off. Poor boy. He has spent more than half of his life here, and he is still delusional. That's too bad. He has not been seeing monsters for quite some time. I'm afraid he may be relapsing. I'm going to have to adjust his meds. The doctor sat down tiredly when we came to the next bench. We had a good view of the forest, the river, and the back of the asylum. It has been a long day. I need a little break, and then I'm going to have to return to my duties. And my door is always open when you take care of your current monster problem. I'm afraid Joan and I don't get many visitors. I do realize that many people find this place kind of depressing. Just a little, I lied. I stretched my legs and studied the intricate architecture of the building. It was a remarkably depressing structure, considering how much good the Nelsons were trying to accomplish. The building was hideously dark. The walls were thick, blocky stone, with carved designs on the edges, and the look was completed by the pair of massive stone gargoyles that sat on the building's roof. Maybe it's the setting? This place looks more like a haunted castle than an institution dedicated to helping people. That it does. But you should have seen it before we bought it from the state.
Joan and I wanted to put our earnings from MHI to good use. This facility is perfect for what we do. Though I will agree, it does bring to mind the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, it looks like what insane asylums look like in horror movies.
Sorry, mental health facilities, I said.
Heck, you even have gargoyles. Isn't that kind of a bad idea with patients who are scared out of their minds by monsters?
He adjusted his absurdly thick glasses and studied the roof.
I may not need to change Travis's medication after all.
Huh?
Our building doesn't have gargoyles.
We watched as one of the giant statues swiveled its horned head as if it was analyzing the air. The other creature slowly and ponderously stretched one of its wings.
Oh, shit, we said in unison.
Chapter 15
Julie, we have gargoyles on the roof, at least two of them.
I shouted into my cell phone as I sprinted around the property for the van and our stash of weapons. Dr. Nelson had left to sound the alarm to lock down the facility.
How big are they?
She asked.
Freaking huge. Probably 10 or 12 feet tall. I think they're the big monsters from my dream.
I leapt over a bench, surprising a patient who had been napping.
Get inside! Run!
I shouted at the patients as I went past. Just as I said that, a horn began to blow. The alarm.
What do we do? I haven't learned about gargoyles yet.
Grab big guns. Explosives. Gargoyles are stone golems. Animated creatures. If you have to engage with small arms, go for the joints. Those are fluid. That's how they move. I'll call Earl.
She hung up. I made my way to the parking lot in an all-out sprint, fumbling in my pocket for my keys. I looked up in time to see a third gargoyle land on the front roof of the Appleton Asylum. The roof splintered and cracked as the creature settled its weight. Its wingspan had to be 40 feet across, and it nearly blotted out the sun. There was a whooshing noise as the monster gently flapped its wings. It settled deeply into a powerful crouch, talons digging into the roof tiles. Massive arms dangled at its sides, ending in pointed claws. Long horns extended from its head and continued down its back, terminating in a stubby tail. The beast was gray and had the texture of poured concrete. It swiveled its head and studied me with blank stone eyes. I crashed into the van, keys in hand. I picked out the correct one, but before I had a chance to insert it, the gargoyle spread its wings and leapt downwards, covering the four stories in an instant. There was no natural explanation for how such a big thing could glide. It landed on the roof of the van, crushing the center, shattering every window, and compressing the shocks. I jumped aside as the van rocked wildly. The gargoyle swung an absurdly long arm at me, and I barely had time to fall backwards as the claws dug long furrows into the asphalt. Patients were screaming, falling to the ground and covering their heads, running or hiding, and a few were just standing there mumbling to themselves. I ran for the entrance, and seconds later heard the concrete stairs break behind me as the creature jumped from the roof of the van. Not looking back, I jerked open the double door and entered the asylum. It closed automatically behind me. Dr. Lucius was there, pushing his way through the panicked crowd. He was breathing hard and his face was gray. The retired hunter knew to fetch us some hardware, though. The doctor shoved a rifle into my hands and then shakily lifted his own. They were old M1 Garand rifles from World War II. He handed me a few 8-round end block clips that I dropped into my pants pocket.
Armor-piercing 30-06. That should get his attention. It's already loaded.
he gasped, and then added, "I'm really far too old for this kind of thing." Patients and staff were moving around us in confusion.
"Get out of the main hallways. Get to your rooms or get to the basement," he ordered.
I stuck my finger in the trigger guard to remove the safety. I pointed it at the door and waited. Nothing happened. The doctor continued to bellow orders over the screaming and hysterical crying. Since I had a moment, I took my electronic earplugs out of my shirt pocket and stuffed them into my ears. If I lived through this, at least I might keep some of my hearing. I quickly studied my surroundings. A large, open room, some ping-pong tables and couches. There was no real cover to use in the common room. Not that a giant stone creature couldn't just bull its way through. I interrupted the doctor's shouted orders.
"You better get out of here. Get your people and go. I'll hold it as long as I can."
I kept the old rifle pointed at the door. I did not know what the creature was waiting for.
"No way. This is my home. No monster pushes me around." "Then we stick and move. Fall back when I tell you to."
Had the creature taken back to the sky? Could I risk returning to the van for some bigger weapons? I caught the doctor nodding out of the corner of my eye. Good. The last thing I wanted was for him to stay here and get turned into paste. Then I heard the noise as stone talons clicked rapidly toward the entrance. There was a tremendous crash as the gargoyle threw itself against the doorframe. Mortar rained from the wall under the impact as the wooden doors broke inward. The heavy wood flew, crumbling into splinters. A horned head appeared through the cloud of dust. The creature tried to crawl through the entrance, but its shoulders were too large. The doctor and I opened fire. I fired my 8 shots in a few seconds, the empty clip ejected with a metallic ping. Dust rose from the gargoyle as the bullet struck. The impacts made small craters in the stone, but the creature was seemingly unfazed. It pulled its massive bulk back and crashed into the frame again, dislodging several heavy stones and knocking them to the floor.
"Fall back, doctor!"
I shouted as I reached into my pocket and pulled out an end-block clip. I thumbed it into the open action, narrowly avoiding getting my thumb pinched as the bolt flew forward. The doctor obliged, and I lost track of him as he retreated toward a side hallway. I took careful aim at the creature, trying to find a joint. The monster's giant stone face opened, showing a throatless mouth filled with huge, blunted teeth. It was a roar, but no sound issued forth. The gargoyle drew back for another run, crashed into the stones, and then backed up to come again. A few more tries and it would be inside. I placed the front sight carefully on the gargoyle's massive neck and fired. The bullet struck high and ricocheted off. I adjusted my aim and shot it again. This time there was a flash of molten liquid as the .30-caliber round punched into softer material. The thing reeled back. It had felt that one. I shot it in the armpit when it tried to cover its throat and was rewarded with another splash. The monster flinched as if in pain and leapt straight into the air and out of my view. I could hear the powerful beating of wings as it soared upwards.
"Dr. Nelson, are you okay?"
Nobody answered. I heard whimpering and crazed babbling from some of the patients who were too confused or paralyzed with fear to run.
"Anybody seen the doctor?"
I shouted again.
"He's over here. I think he's hurt,"
someone called. Dr. Lucius had made it a few yards down the hallway before he had fallen. He was clutching his chest, and his face was contorted in a grimace. A female patient was cradling his head, and an orderly was trying to help him.
"Heart,"
the doctor said. Sweat was rolling off of his forehead, and he had lost his glasses.
"Oh, hell,"
For all I knew, the gargoyle could be coming back any second. "Get him out of here. Drag him if you have to. Find a doctor or a nurse or something." The orderly and the patient complied. There was a loud crash from above, and dust fell from the ceiling. "Julie!" I sprinted back into the common room and up the stairs. I barely reached the second floor when the entryway exploded in a cloud of stone, wood, and debris. Pieces of furniture were hurled clear to the second-floor balcony. The gargoyle had not retreated at all. Rather, it had taken to the air to build momentum. The thing rolled crazily through the foyer, turning furniture into kindling. I had no idea if all of the patients had evacuated or not, though I doubted it, and I had no time to find out. The unnatural creature stood on its crooked hind legs, and somehow I knew it was searching for me. Its wings unfurled outwards, filling the big room and shattering many of the barred windows. The Garand barked as I fired down on the beast. The gargoyle folded one huge wing over its body like a shield, and the bullet shattered against it. The empty end block clip automatically ejected, and I reached for a new one as I resumed running. The center of the Appleton Asylum was one large room, with stairs that circled clear to the top. I knew from my conversation with Dr. Lucius that the maximum security ward was on the top floor. I pushed myself as fast as I could go, fervently wishing that I had spent more time on the company stairmaster. Unable to spread its mighty wings inside the confines of the asylum, the gargoyle clambered up the stairs after me. It crawled rather than walked, long arms extended. The stairs and support boards cracked as each stone claw came crashing down. So far, the creature appeared to be ignoring the patients and concentrating on me. I did not know if the gargoyle was targeting me because it somehow knew I was a hunter, or because I had the nerve to shoot it, or because it recognized me from my dream. The gargoyle paused as something struck it from behind. It swiveled at the base of the stairs. A patient was standing defiant, holding Dr. Nelson's rifle. It was the man who had not liked hunters. I believe his name was Barney. He held the rifle at his waist, pointing it in the general direction of the monster.
"I hid from you demons last time when you ate my kids, but not this time. Die, you son of a bitch!" Blam!
He jerked the trigger. The first shot fragmented off of the monster's wide chest. The next shot impacted the wall, 4 inches from my head. The patient laughed in glee.
"I'm free! I'm finally free!"
He shot the creature in the foot.
"Barney, run! Get out of here!"
I shot the gargoyle in the back, but the armored wings covered all of the vulnerable joints. The creature absently flicked one long arm, talons spread wide. Barney exploded in a red haze. His lifeless torso bounced off the wall, leaving a huge stain of blood and entrails on the bright paint. He slid to the ground, almost cut in two. Having dealt with the annoyance, the monster turned and regarded me with lifeless eyes. I ran. Third floor. The gargoyle was directly under me and gaining fast. It was cumbersome, but it was impossibly large and covered a lot of stairs with each lunge. I leaned dangerously far over the edge and fired at it. The creature barely slowed as most of the bullets bounced harmlessly off of its stone body. I was going to need a bigger gun if I wanted to do anything other than just piss it off.
"Owen! Up here, quick!"
Julie shouted from the fourth-floor balcony. She had her pistol in one hand and was guiding a straight-jacketed man with the other. Dr. Joan was behind them, aghast at the destruction being visited upon her facility. I clambered up the stairs toward them. I heard Julie order the doctor to take her father, and then gunfire broke out as she tried to slow the climbing gargoyle.
"Down that hall,"
Julie gestured with her head as I reached her position. She was inserting a new magazine into her 1911. She dropped the slide.